Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Well, the federal government may not have brought in a budget in 2 years, but the Ontario government has announced it will unveil its second COVID-19 budget on March 24th. And we got some pretty strong hints from the finance minister on how he plans, or perhaps more accurately, doesn't plan to balance the books down the road. A nasty exchange in the legislature prompts a private apology from the premier to an Indigenous NDP MPP. Also, are you too tempted by all the junk food at the checkout counter of your local supermarket? Another NDP MPP has an idea on how to stop that. It's Tuesday, March 16th, 2021, 1 year since COVID-19 took over our lives. So let's get to it.
On March 24th, I will deliver Ontario's 2021 budget. Our government's second pandemic budget will focus on protecting people's health.
That's Finance Minister Peter Bethlenfalvy now confirming Ontario will bring in its fiscal year 2021-22 budget in 8 days. That's Wednesday, March 24th. Every budget has a theme. What has the Finance Ministry JMM suggested the theme of this budget will be?
Well, Steve, the Finance Minister was pretty subtle about it. You tell me if you can detect the theme here.
Protecting people's health and people's jobs is our number one priority. And we'll protect people's jobs and economic well-being as we continue to face this pandemic. Our focus has got to be protecting health and jobs today. Without healthy people, you can't have a healthy economy.
Okay, well, John Michael, I've been at this a little bit longer than you have, so let me take a crack at explaining this one, because as you can imagine, it does require a lot of analysis, of subtle political theory, reading between the lines. So here goes. The theme of the budget is going to be health and jobs.
Exactly right. I was personally lobbying for a chicken in every pot, a car in every garage, but I didn't win that fight. The finance minister made that announcement last week.
Well, I appreciate that vote of confidence. And let me stipulate that, yes, the coronavirus is still a dangerous problem for society. And yes, we still need more people to get vaccinated. And yes, the recovering from the economic devastation of the past year is uneven, but we are starting to see signs of economic improvement. The national fourth quarter growth rate in Canada, John Michael, it was almost 10%, suggesting a lot of pent-up economic activity is still to come. As a result, there is much interest in whether Finance Minister Bethlenfalvy intends to put the brakes on spending and lay out some kind of long-range path to balancing the books. What can you tell us on that?
Technically, the law requires the finance minister to lay out a plan to balance the province's books in any fiscal year where there's a deficit. If anyone listening is really interested, it's Section 4 of the Financial Transparency and Accountability Act. You knew that I was going to have the nerdy stuff here. But the finance minister was asked directly about that, and he didn't really give a direct answer. But it is fair to say that they are not looking at big tax increases or big program cuts, or at least no program cuts larger than they have already planned to balance the books. Bethlenfalvy is, you know, a big believer in making government more efficient and more digital. So I certainly think we can expect more of that in the budget. But, you know, it's a question this finance minister or any finance minister would have to answer. You know, how do you lay out a plan to balance the books without tax increases or spending cuts? That's not a political point. It's really just a mathematical one. If you don't raise taxes or cut spending, you're just not going to balance the budget for, you know, 25 years. But, you know, maybe no politician can really say that part out loud.
Well, let's just see if we can demystify this a bit. I think everybody understands what no tax increases means. I think they understand what no spending cuts means. What does, because this is one of the things he does suggest, what does a stronger partnership with the federal government refer to?
I'm going to perform a small play here in the role of the finance minister. Dear Ottawa, please give us more money, especially a lot more money for the Canada Health Transfer. This is, of course, a perennial issue between Ottawa and the provinces. The whole point to healthcare, at least initially, was that this was going to be something, a financial burden that was shared between the provinces and the federal government. The federal government's share of the funding has shrunk consistently over the decades. Provinces would obviously like to see that number go back up. They are not even, you know, in the same universe as asking for like a 50% share, but they are asking for that number to go up. And, you know, you currently have a Liberal government, a government that, you know, is a, let's say, Justin Trudeau got elected announcing his plans to spend a deficit. He's clearly not a small government conservative in that sense. So maybe the provinces think that they have a shot at shaking some more money out of Ottawa these days.
Well, you just had your moment, so I'm going to take my moment now where I do the little nerd thing down memory lane. It was back in the mid-1960s when the federal government brought in Medicare, offering to pay half the shot, 50-50, splitting the cost with the provinces. And John Robarts, who was then the Premier of Ontario, called it, if you can imagine, a Machiavellian scheme. That's right. the most cherished social program in Canada we have, John Robarts called a Machiavellian scheme because he foresaw the day when the feds and the provinces wouldn't split the cost 50-50. He saw the day coming when the feds would try to lessen their responsibility. And of course, they have. And the federal government now might be paying 23% or so of the shot of Medicare, with the provinces left to pick up the rest. So if you're wondering, why are the provinces constantly after the feds to pay more of the shot for Medicare? There's your reason right there. It was supposed to be 50-50 in the first place. It's a long way from that now. Okay, the Treasurer has pointed out that if you compare third quarter spending from a year ago to now, Ontario is spending $25 billion more year over year, obviously COVID-19. He says that is simply not sustainable. So if it's not, JMM, what's the alternative?
The finance minister talked a lot about cutting red tape. You know, the language we've heard from this government before, making Ontario open for business, really creating the conditions for greater economic growth, purchasing more made in Ontario goods. And, you know, Ontario was not doing that badly in terms of jobs growth before the pandemic. So even if we simply return to the pre-pandemic norm, you could expect some pretty robust jobs growth. We are still not there. As much as Canada has had some good jobs growth, you know, in the most recent report, Ontario is still like in the bottom half of provinces in terms of being closest to its pre-pandemic employment levels. But there's, you know, reasons for optimism. And we talk about, for example, you know, debt to GDP or deficit as a share of GDP. And, you know, that implies that one way to balance the books is to grow the economy. There's also reasons for skepticism. you know, this province was doing okay on jobs growth, but it also had a, you know, a nearly $10 billion deficit before the pandemic too. So getting us back to, you know, pre-COVID 2020 might just get us back to having that $10 billion deficit instead of having the $25 billion deficit. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is our setup look at next week's Ontario budget. We're going to move on now. And let's talk about something that was, I think it's one of the most unfortunate incidents I can ever recall in the history of Ontario politics. And that is the rhetoric that got overheated in the House last week. It was on Thursday when Premier Doug Ford accused an NDP member of the legislature named Saul Mamakwa, who is of Indigenous heritage. He accused Mr. Mamakwa of jumping the queue when it came to getting a vaccine.
Not only did Orange fly in, but the member flew in too to get his vaccine. So thank you for doing that and kind of jumping the line, as I talked to a few chiefs that were pretty upset about that. Order. For flying into a community that he doesn't belong, but that's here nor there.
Now, John Michael, we should note that late Friday, the Premier's office announced that the Premier had apologized to MPP Mamakwa in a private phone call, but we need some more background here. Give us the background and why this statement of the Premier's, the notion that Mamakwa was jumping the queue, why this was so particularly problematic.
You know, as you say, it's one of the most unfortunate examples we've had in a while. Mamakwa is from Kingfisher Lake First Nation in Ontario's very far northwest. but he was invited by the chief of Muskrat Dam First Nation to come get his first vaccine dose there because the chief of Muskrat Dam was seeing some early numbers suggesting that only about 2/3 of Indigenous residents there were signing up to take the first dose of the Moderna vaccine. And so the chief reached out to Mr. Mamakwa as an Indigenous leader to say, like, hey, would you come get your first dose here as a way of raising the profile and showing people that it is safe? You know, this is a really, really critical time because if there is a bad COVID outbreak in any of Ontario's remote First Nations, it will be a tragedy because we have no real capacity to move dozens or hundreds of people into ICU units from the remote north. It's just, it will just be a disaster if it happens. So getting these people vaccinated and getting them vaccinated quickly is extremely important. So it's extremely important to address that vaccine hesitancy, and that is part of what Mamakwa was doing when he got his first dose in Muskrat Dam. He would later get a second dose. Both he and the NDP have been very, very public about what he's been doing.
And let's remind everybody why this is such an issue. You know, there really are echoes of colonialism in a lot of the relationship between Queen's Park and Indigenous people in Ontario. And, you know, we have certainly covered on the agenda and have spoken to Indigenous people who have been on our program and said things like they have heard either doctors or nurses in hospitals or healthcare centers say things like, oh, it's another drunken Indian, when somebody comes in with, you know, let's say a burst appendix or something like that. So there's some understandable concern when, quote unquote, colonial people show up and say, take this dose of vaccine. That's why the Mamakwa intervention was so important. I think this is a big problem for Doug Ford for a couple of reasons. Never mind that the most powerful person in the province is taking a cheap shot, inaccurate as well, at an opposition member who I think is from the northernmost riding in all of Ontario. It's a long way up there. He represents a lot of struggling people. He is, Saul Mamakwa, one of the most dignified people at the legislature ever. I mean, I've never heard him raise his voice during question period. How many politicians can you say that about? He conducts himself with considerable dignity. And Doug Ford had done so well showing empathy and putting his sort of bully image that made up a big part of his first year in office on the back burner. But this incident is what marketing people would call very off-brand. This is beyond politically incorrect. This was a scandalous allegation against somebody who didn't deserve it. The premier shouldn't have said it. It's good that he apologized, at least privately, but I wonder if that's the end of it.
Well, I mean, on the point of the private apology, I think there is also a an argument that he should, at the very least, correct the record when the House returns a week from now, just before the budget. He's going to have plenty of opportunity to stand up in the House and say, I was wrong. I shouldn't have said that. And, you know, I don't want to say the Premier has to drag this out and you know, crawl on his knees to Canterbury or anything. But, you know, there's a record of proceedings at Queen's Park, and the Premier should correct it. That said, there's another thing that Mr. Mamakwa said last week that I think was educational for me, and I think it's worth restating here, because part of the accusation that was made was that Saul Mamakwa had left his community or had gone to a community that wasn't his because he is from the Kingfisher Lake First Nation and he went to Muskrat Dam. But the point that the MPP for Kiwetinohk was making, or one of the points that he made on Friday, was that, you know, this is a way of seeing everything through that colonial lens, that, you know, the First Nations that exist in Ontario, in these territories that are defined by federal law, they were created by Canada through treaty processes where Indigenous people were not really given an equal footing. And these identities, as much as, you know, Saul Mamakwa has been, you know, very open about it, you know, he's from Kingfisher Lake, he talks of himself in that way, but these identities do not reflect the full diversity of identity in Indigenous people. So even just to describe this as Mamakwa traveling from one First Nation to another is it's imposing the settler label, frankly, on this issue when you could choose to see it in so many more charitable and probably more accurate ways. As I say, it was an educational moment for me, and I think it's worth restating here.
Well said. Now, on Sunday, Doug Ford held a media event during which he said, well, yeah, it was a bit of a cheap shot, but that's just politics, and sometimes things get overheated in a partisan atmosphere, and I'm just sticking up for my party. That's my job. Words to that effect. Saul Mamakwa responded to that with a tweet of his own later that evening. How did that go?
Fair to say that Mr. Mamakwa is not pleased with the premier's restatement of things. Has all but called the premier's actions racist, and says he's set back the cause of encouraging Indigenous people to get vaccinated. Certainly, I have seen a number of chiefs from First Nations in Ontario, as well as the Ontario Regional Chief, Roseanne Archibald, and the Assembly of First Nations have all warned the premier that on top of whatever offense he caused to Mr. Mamakwa, the issue of getting Indigenous people in remote First Nations vaccinated is simply too important to play politics with.
Amen. All right, moving on. We often talk about culture on this podcast, not just because we love good books and good films and plays and museums and art galleries and sporting events for how they fill our souls, but also, shall we get crass here? Because they happen to bring $36 billion worth of economic activity into the province as well. And those cultural industries have been hit particularly hard during the past year. Lisa McLeod is the Minister of Heritage, Sport, Tourism, and Culture Industries. And I spoke with her to get some idea of how she intends to help bring those industries back. Minister, you're creating this new Tourism Economic Recovery Task Force. What's the mission of this task force going to be?
Well, thanks. It's building off of our white paper, which will end up into a five-year plan. But specifically what the task force that will be led by Tim Hudak will do, we'll look at the Ontario travel incentive that will be moving forward, hopefully later this summer when it's safe to travel, which is a 20% tax credit. We want to make sure that we have itineraries based on that tax credit so that people know not only that it exists, but what they can use it for. The second thing is Toronto and Ottawa are gateway cities. Our nation's capital and our provincial capital have been hardest hit in the pandemic in the sense that their travel and tourism has not only declined for leisure travel, but business travel has been non-existent. So we're creating a subcommittee of gateway cities with Ottawa and Toronto, who both have international airports, major convention centers, which are owned by this ministry, the Metro Toronto Convention Center and the Shaw Center. They also have most of the cultural assets in the province. In Toronto, most of them happen to be aligned with this ministry. In Ottawa, they happen to be aligned with our sister ministry of heritage federally. So we want to really look at how do we get them back up and running in a post-pandemic. And finally, we want to look at some of the signature destinations that we have across Ontario that you can't find anywhere, whether that's in Kenora, in the Lake of the Woods, or Niagara Falls, or the beautiful Thousand Islands and Muskoka regions and all other areas in between. We want to make sure that they are prepared for tourism in a post-pandemic reality. So the work started in earnest last week. They're meeting every Thursday for the next 5 to 6 weeks. And we're expecting a report sometime mid-April in order to really activate this recovery.
Here's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question, but could you not find anybody better than Tim Hudak to chair this thing?
Well, you know, Tim and I have served in the legislature for many, many years.
I know.
But what he really brings to the table, two specific things. The first is early on in the pandemic, I reached out to him to moderate many of my telephone town halls. I have been actively engaging with my sector partners throughout the entire pandemic. So he's hosted about 14 different telephone town halls for me. So the stakeholders know him, but they also know him because he's a former Minister of Tourism and former Minister of Northern Mine and Development. And so he was actually the minister during 9/11, the last time Ontario's border was shut. So he brought a great skill set to this, a political lens, but also he understands the sectors. And so I thought that was a great component. And he seems to be having fun with it.
People listening to this are going to want to know how much these folks are being paid to do this work for you.
It's all volunteer. My ministry, as you know, was hardest hit. First hit will take the longest to recover. Any money that we want to support will be to individuals like we did today, with $2.5 million going into the live music sector. Yesterday, $2 million going into our museums. Next week, I'll have significant money going into tourism as well as into sport. So that's my focus. And of course, Tim has been volunteering his time for us for the past year.
I'm not sure people realize how big a deal tourism and cultural industries and so on play in the overall economy of the province of Ontario. So this might be a good time to remind people what you think the stakes are here to ensure that we get this thing back on the rails.
Yeah, it's over a half a million jobs. It's $76 billion in the economy. It is the ultimate small business sector, the largest volunteer sector, the largest not-for-profit sector. We deal with some of the biggest brands in the world. You know, it's something that I think previously, before we rebranded the ministry to represent the spectacular double bottom line of the cultural fabric, but also the economic imprint, I don't think people understood it. But when you look at everything in your own community, whether that is your neighborhood soccer field, it is your local restaurant, it's the local art gallery, it's the vendor on the street that is encouraging you to buy tickets for a sightseeing tour, they all play a vital role. And the stakes are very high. Destination Canada, the federal agency that looks after the branding and marketing of tourism for the nation, says that one in 10 jobs in Canada rely on this sector. So again, every one of us knows somebody in this, in the hospitality culture. And it's not just what you think. I think sometimes when we talk culture, we think, oh, the opera. I think when we think tourism, we think, okay, well, that's me going on a plane and going to Mexico. And when we think heritage, we think of history books. We don't think of some of the valuable museums that contribute to all of this. And soccer, look, Steve, I'm a hockey mom. Tori is running around behind me right now. We usually go on 3 or 4 tournaments a year across Ontario. And think about the economic impact for a Brampton or a Mississauga or Gananoque when that entire weekend, hundreds of kids and their parents and their coaches and their fans are choosing that place as a destination. That's how important this is. And that's why I'm so passionate about it, because it really is what makes Ontario such a great place to live.
Well, let me give a much bigger example, and that's the Toronto Blue Jays, one of the major brands that you just mentioned a moment ago. They're under your purview, and I'm most interested in what you think about the fact that the Texas Rangers, for example, have decided to have their opening day with a full crowd in Arlington, Texas, at the stadium. Could we do that here?
Not at the moment, I'll go back to hockey, because that's the plans that I've been working with most in terms of the NHL and the AHL and now the OHL. We're not in a place in Ontario where we can get fans in stands. The inoculation rates are higher in the United States at the moment. We need to be at a good place there. But when we talk about that, it's not, and that's also. Sport is one area. The other area that we're looking is live music. What does that look like toward the end of the summer? And so there's a number of components that will have to be part of that: inoculation, rapid testing, physical distancing if still required. So we aren't at that stage yet. But I can tell you, a couple of weeks ago, Cabinet appointed me to do the seasonal reopenings, because most of them, probably 90% of it, are my sectors. And these are things that we're actively looking at, my ministry, as well as the Ministry of Health. And we don't have a crystal ball when that will happen, but so much of what we do in this ministry revolves around needing people congregating together.
Do you have any recent polling which would point to what conditions have to be in place before people will feel comfortable congregating in big public arenas again?
Yeah, so the last data that we would have had would be a couple months old, and I'll continue to, I think we're going into the field very shortly, just to get a sense of what consumer sentiment and behavior will look like post-pandemic. We recognize that there are still a sizable amount of people in Ontario, in our communities, that will not go back to the way things used to be, and that's about 20%. I'd say there's about 20% that just are ready to go no matter what, and then there's a lot of folks in between that will require a lot of parameters. And the early data that we had early on in the pandemic through Ipsos was that in order to build back consumer sentiments, The venue or the operator must demonstrate, and hopefully by video, how the experience will be safe, how you can, and how not only the vendor can protect you, but also how the steps you can personally take. So there is a fair degree of personal responsibility that people are feeling as well to guard and keep themselves safe. But I guess this is the big challenge too, because so much of what we do in this ministry is about socialization. And as we are, you know, social creatures by habit, it really is going to be very hard. So we're going to have some challenges, and I'll talk a little bit more about it next week. Sport, you know, how do we rebuild confidence for moms and dads who want to put their kids in sport? We know there's lots of them that are still excited about it, but there are many other parents that say, maybe not, maybe that contact is too close. And so we're going to have, like, with the whole gamut, we're going to have to really build out those protocols, but that work is being done.
Can I ask you about the budget?
Sure.
I'd like to know what you essentially have told Finance Minister Peter Bethlen Falvey that you need, that if he doesn't come through with, he is off your Christmas card list forever.
I can tell you that Peter Bethlen Falvey will be on my Christmas card list for the rest of my life.
Because?
He understands that my sectors were hardest hit. And, you know, I'm on the Jobs and Recovery Committee with him, and my colleagues know, they, when I enter a room, they say the following things. My sectors were hit first, hardest, will take the longest to recover. We are a spectacular double bottom line, both the cultural fabric and the economic imprint. And they also know that I'm going to say that we need their support. So I often will say that we're a triple threat too. We're the ones that are dealing with the healthcare, economic, and social crisis. And so they often repeat it because I keep making the case. And so I, without getting into too many details, I can say with great confidence that the initiatives that we laid out in our white paper will come to fruition.
Let's do one more question here. And that is, you're also the minister who has purview over the Ontario Hockey League. That's junior hockey in our province. That's 17 teams. That's 17 communities from the Sioux to your own Ottawa to Windsor, all of whom would like to see their teams playing again. And they, of course, haven't played yet. What's the status of all of that?
Yeah, the proposals that we saw early on were not approved by the Chief Medical Officer of Health. So my team at the ministry has been working around the clock, actually, with the OHL to level up those standards to something that's similar to the AHL and the NHL. And we're getting there. I feel very confident. The proposals that I've seen this past week, and as I was in Toronto yesterday, another new deck came for me. I'm extremely confident that we're getting to a place where the Chief Medical Officer of Health will be far more comfortable than what he was in the past. And if we get to that point, whether that's a hub model, whatever, as long as the players are protected, then we could see body contact, because that, as you know, right now in the current regulations, there's no contact in any sport unless you've gotten the regulatory approval. So that's all there. It's in place. We're working hard with them. And, you know, we have a number of other sports that need to get up and running as well. So we've got a number of proposals that we're working on with health to try and really you know, reopen the economy. And here's another thing, Steve, a lot of things, and I'll talk to you about my $76 billion, you know, $36 billion is tourism, $26 billion is culture, but sport and recreation in Ontario represent $12.6 billion in economic activity. And so again, the OHL is an economic contributor in, you know, Sault Ste. Marie, in Kingston, in London, you know, so it's important that when we get them back up, that we get them back up safely, and we make sure that they're financially viable in the long run.
As always, good of you to spend so much time with us. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Steve.
That's Lisa McLeod, Minister of Heritage, Sport, Tourism and Culture Industries, and the MPP for Nepean in Eastern Ontario.
And one more item for your interest. New Democrat MPP France Gélinas from Nickel Belt, that's around Sudbury, is pitching a private member's bill that would tackle the temptation to buy junk food when you're at the checkout counter after buying your groceries. Her bill is called the Temptation Be Gone Act. How's that for a good name? And it would prevent supermarkets, mom-and-pop operations, and everything in between from selling, displaying, or marketing all junk food like chocolate bars and soda pop and energy drinks and so on. You know how they keep those by the checkout counters while you're waiting in line. You just can't resist the temptation to grab a chocolate bar while you're waiting and so on. No more free refills either. No more two-for-one sales or other high volume discounts by the snack bar, by the checkout counter either.
So to celebrate Nutrition Month, I'm introducing a bill to discourage the promotion of highly processed food that are high in fat, sugar, and sodium. I call the bill Temptation Be Gone.
Now, Madame Gelinas says she got this idea from a pharmacist in Sudbury named Rachel Roca, who stocks healthy food near the checkout. What a novel idea. Now, apparently, there's a similar bill that's passed the UK Parliament. Gelinas' bill has the support of the Heart and Stroke Foundation and the Canadian Cancer Society, and she points out 40% of cancers could be prevented with a healthier lifestyle. Of course, and this is important for those of us who do like our odd bit of chocolate every now and then, junk food would still be available to be sold, but only in the aisles with all the other food, not by the checkout counter, where apparently most of us are likely to be tempted. Okay, with all of that in place, John Michael McGrath, what do you think?
I sort of suspect that the current government is not going to be interested in pursuing this private members bill. It sounds, the premier has railed against, you know, nanny states and that and big government before, and I kind of think this would be under that category heading for him. And it's worth reminding people that private members' bills very, very rarely pass at the legislature. But they're also not intended to pass all the time. You know, MPPs bring these bills forward not because they necessarily think that they are, you know, 100% going to become law, but as a way of raising the profile of these issues. And, you know, as I say, probably not under this government, but perhaps under a future one. Either Ms. Gelinas' bill could be brought back if it's a new Democrat government in the future, or even if there's a reasonably friendly Liberal government. You could imagine a private member's bill like this being incorporated into a government bill later. Certainly, we saw a lot of that during the McGuinty and Wynne years.
Indeed. Okay, we always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have those for you immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, what you didn't, and help make this podcast just a little bit better.
You can also shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org. Here's a note from Benjamin King on Twitter, who writes, "Steve says you'll do all the nerdy public policy stuff, but we also appreciate you for doing the nerdy data processing stuff." for those who aren't following me on Twitter, basically since the pandemic began, I've been keeping track of the daily case counts and vaccinations and cases in schools and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so follow the guy, JM_McGrath. And when did you start doing all that anyway?
I started it in April, and it kind of started as a bit of a lark. We were getting all of these numbers from the province, and I just wanted to start storing them away in some kind of organized fashion. So I just opened a spreadsheet and started doing it. And then before I knew it, I was, you know, making charts daily for TVO's website. And then I, you know, had no reason to keep them exclusive to TVO. So I just started tweeting them out as well.
You know, I seem to recall somebody, I think I recall you putting out a tweet a while ago saying something like, "I do this every day and I'm happy to do it, but I don't know if anybody cares or is interested or is reading these things. You folks still want me to do this?" And apparently you got quite an onslaught of responses from people saying, "Yes, keep doing it. We need it." Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, that was back in either late August or early September. You know, things had sort of quieted down on the COVID front for a moment. And, you know, I just I asked people whether it was still useful. And boy, the earful I got from Twitter followers convinced me to keep going. For good or ill, at the moment, the spreadsheet is all built to keep going until the end of the year, though I certainly hope I won't need it that long. If people are like super interested about my Excel spreadsheet, which is a weird sentence to say in this day and age, but I did write something for not TVO. I got permission to write for an outside website called The Local. If you Google them, so The Local Toronto, I wrote a longer piece about what it's been like to live with COVID data in my head all year.
John Michael, I am so interested in your Excel spreadsheet. I may very well just go do that. Okay, here now is my quote of the week, and I'm going to go back to the statement Premier Ford made in the legislature last week, accusing MPP Saul Mamakwa of jumping the queue, which turned out to be a false allegation.
Well, again, through you, Mr. Speaker, that was one of our highest priorities to go into the 31 fly-in communities. Not only did Orange fly in, but the member flew in too to get his vaccine. So thank you for doing that and kind of jumping the line as I talked to a few chiefs that were pretty upset about that.
Order.
For flying into a community that he doesn't belong, but that's here nor there.
Now, I have written a column on the TVO website, that's tvo.org/theagenda, in which I suggest this may be the worst thing I have ever heard any premier say to any opposition member ever. I've known the last 9 premiers of Ontario. I have seen a lot of question periods. I explain why this may just be the worst thing I've ever heard. tvo.org/theagenda.
And I don't think either of us would love for the premier to have the last word on this matter, so I am going to give my quote of the week to Saul Mamakwa, who removed the word reconciliation from his critic title at Queen's Park earlier this year. On Friday, during his press conference, I asked Mr. Mamakwa why he did that, and this was part of his answer.
And so I think, you know, I came to understand, you know, removing reconciliation, like why am I trying to promote reconciliation whereby this government will say things but not, again, actions speak louder than words. And with there's no action with this government when we talk about reconciliation.
That's Saul Mamakwa, the MPP for Kiwetinung, speaking at Queen's Park on Friday.
And that was episode 103 of the On Poly podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, with editing wizardry from Matthew O'Mara. Our production support coordinators are Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell. JMM, you know how we like to close this thing. As my dad says, stay positive, test negative.
The finance minister used your line again last week too, Steve.
Not quite. He says it backwards. And because he says it backwards, I let him get away with it and I don't sue him for copyright infringement. He always says, test negative, stay positive. So he's not exactly cribbing my dad, which I think is okay.
In any event, I hope you and your copyright lawyers stay safe.
Thank you.